disparaging manner. We hear things from the servants, you know. Before long, the bus dropped me off in the village, and I only had to walk to the Great House to collect myself. My meetings with aristocracy have been few and far between, and even though they don't have the authority they once did, they still send a wave of panic through me. If only I had been Mrs. B, with her so-called royal connections and indefatigable self-confidence. Although I very much doubt Mrs. B would have agreed to this undertaking, especially since it involves something both unsavoury and illegal. Heaven help poor Carrington, as she would have him marched off to Parnham Police Station within the hour. I was also incredibly nervous that my task was neither pleasant nor straightforward. Which son was I supposed to tell? What if the Viscount was the only one there and insisted on knowing my errand? What was I to say? After a long walk through the mansion parkland, the main house came into sight. A sprawling Regency facade. A double staircase separating and converging up to the massive front door. I shuddered as I approached, knowing that I was being observed as a shadow disappeared from behind a ground-floor window, my pull on the bell anticipated, my purpose already considered. Holding the door ajar, and waiting for my swift departure, the antiquated butler informed me promptly and pompously that the Viscount was not at home. "I've come to see his son," I said quickly, snaking around him into the hall. I hadn't come this far to be palmed off. "I shall inquire within," he said snootily, and showed me into a chilly drawing-room. The interior was grand and austere, but empty-looking and rather dismal. The faded colours, sage green, dove blue, had become grey with age, and I knew for a certainty that if I saw a duster lying around, I wouldn't have been able to help myself. The smell of wax polish and antique mothballs added to the starchy gloom. I felt completely alien and distinctly uncomfortable. The door presently opened, and a young man entered. Thank goodness I knew straight away that he was the one. Still slim from youth, he was medium height and rather dark in complexion and looks, walking in with a self-conscious deliberation, steady, slow, ponderous. One of his legs was obviously wounded, his trouser leg bulking with bandages as he limped forward. And when he looked up at me, his eyes avoided mine, glancing out of the great terrace window and then at the fireplace. He seemed so vulnerable. There was some deep discomfort in him, an estrangement from everything surrounding him. "Hello," I smiled warmly, suddenly conscious that my mission was about to bring me closer to this man than most of the people he knew. "I'm Mrs. Margaret Tilling, from Chilbury." "Do take a seat," he said in a very upper-class voice. He didn't return my smile, which I thought was both painfully understandable yet incredibly rude, although how was he to know my horrific errand? I perched on the edge of a taut beige brocade sofa. He limped over to the couch opposite and gently picked up a cushion before sitting down, measuring every movement as to the effect on his leg. He sighed and looked out of the window again, over the folds of hills to the bittersweet blue of the sea. Nazi-occupied France only 20 miles across the water, snarling on the horizon like an evil inevitability. "What brings you to these parts, Mrs. Tilling?" he said, as if reading from an etiquette manual, exasperated by the need to deal with me. "I have a message from Barclay." His eyes darted straight to mine. His eye contact at once total and gripped. His bottom lip fell open slightly, taking in what I had said. A cascade of thoughts must have flooded his brain. "What message?" he breathed. "I was the nurse looking after him at Dover. He made me promise to give you this." I opened my hand and held out the ring. Carrington spluttered a cough, although I think he was covering a cry. He didn't rush to look at the ring. He must have already known the object, seen it, touched it, held it. He sat for a while, then came over and took it, tucking it away in an inside pocket. Then he walked over to the terrace window, looking over the manicured gardens and hills, the parallel lines of classical statues and symmetrical garrisons of topiary bushes. "It's mine, you know," he said quietly. "The ring." He turned to me. "I gave it to him 4 years ago. We were at boarding school together." He became self-conscious and examined his hands. "What did he say?" "He told me to tell you he loved you." I shuddered silently. "He was so terribly weak." My words faded out, and the brutal memory of Barclay came back to me. The hopeless fear in his eyes, his young form turning limp and lifeless. I looked at Carrington. His eyes seemed broken as he struggled to regain his countenance. He looked out of the window away onto the horizon, tears welling uncontrollably. A few dreadful minutes passed. I suddenly wondered if I'd been wrong. Perhaps he didn't already know that his friend had died. Had I unconsciously broken the worst news he could ever want to hear? "I'm sorry," I stammered. "I thought you knew. I thought, well, I didn't know what to think." "I did know," he mumbled, clearing his throat. "His mother telephoned. She knew we were friends, although she never knew." He cut off, frowning inscrutably. "I don't mind if you hand me in, you know," he said, a stern pride controlling his tears. "You can do your worst. I don't care. I have nothing left to hide." He looked pensively at the drifting clouds and added in a rather dreamy way, "I have nothing left at all." "I'm not going to hand you in," I said as gently as I could. "I made a promise to him." I paused, thinking this was all far stranger than I had imagined. He came and sat back down on the sofa opposite me. "Tell me what happened." "He kept talking about you. How you'd be lost without each other. That he was the lucky one for dying first. And then he rolled over, his breath slowing until it finally slowed." My words were fizzling out. "To a stop. I know it didn't happen exactly like that, but this is surely what Barclay would have wanted me to say. I remember when Harold died, yearning for him to speak my name or give me a message. But he didn't. And the best that I can do is to find some kind of peace by giving this gift to someone else." Carrington put his head down and wept into his large hands. I sat watching for a while, feeling like I was intruding, wondering if I should leave. Then I looked out onto the horizon myself, and realized that loss is the same wherever you go. Overwhelming, inexorable, deafening. How resilient human beings are that we can learn slowly to carry on when we are left all alone, left to fill the void as best we can, or disappear into it. I went over and sat next to him, and after a minute or two, I put my arm around him, and he turned and wept silently into my shoulder. I wondered if I was the only person who knew, the only shoulder he had. The sound of a distant door opening and heavy footsteps in the hall announced the return of the Viscount, and Carrington stood quickly and limped over to the window, promptly composing himself, wiping his face with a handkerchief. "That's my father," he said without looking around. "He wouldn't understand." "No, I imagine he wouldn't." "Thank you for coming," he added slowly, "and I took this to be my cue to leave." He clearly didn't want his father inquiring after my purpose for calling. As I stood and straightened myself, he turned and said, "Really? Thank you, Mrs. Tilling." He smiled, and I caught a glimpse of a different man, a different world, a handsome youth who might have enjoyed life had he not been wrenched into the centre of a bloody war. "Mrs. Tilling," he said, "may I visit you sometime? I mean, if I survive this beastly war. I shrugged. Of course you can. I live in Chilbury, Ivy House. He smiled again, genuine connection in his eyes, and I knew that I would see him again, hopefully on a better day, under happier circumstances. Things will get easier, you know. He opened the door for me and we went into the magnificent hallway. A dual staircase rolled up on both sides and came together in a type of royal balcony overlooking the expanse of parquet flooring. A clock ticked interminably, and I just wanted to get out, launch myself away from this oppressive place, and into the fresh and wild outdoors. The butler was waiting for us, his gaze meeting my eye. Then he turned and gave a rather circumspect grimace to young Carrington. "I informed the Viscount that you had a visitor, and he requested to meet her," he said pompously. "If you would be so kind as to wait here, madam, I will fetch him directly." He bowed again and strode off into the passage. I felt a thud in my stomach. I was going to meet the Viscount, whether I liked it or not. Carrington had gone rather pale. "I expect he just wants to see if you're a young lady, some romantic hopeful, if you know what I mean," he said, attempting a smile. "Yes," I said wearily, hoping but not expecting him to be right. He wasn't. The Viscount stormed into the hall, bellowing, "What's all this, then?" He was a large man in all senses of the word, with a full head of greying hair curling round his burgundy necktie. He looked both immaculate and furious, stalking up to me and declaring rudely, "Who, may I ask, are you, and what do you want with my son?" "I'm Mrs. Margaret Tilling," I said in the best voice I could muster, praying that something clever would come out of my mouth. "I was a nurse at Dover, and I had a message from a friend of your son's." I paused while he looked at me, expecting more. "He never made it."
"If it was that swine Berkeley, he's better off dead," he snarled at Carrington, who looked through him with practiced calm. "Poisoning my son with these notions."
"He is dead," I heard my own voice pipe up, strong and audible through the vast hall. "He died that night at Dover, from a wound fighting off the Nazis at Dunkirk. He was a brave soldier and deserves to be remembered as such."
"He deserved to be remembered as nothing but a degenerate. He should have been hanged."
"And yet it was all right that he gave his life for this country. Why can't you take off your blinkered glasses and see what is in front of your eyes? The man was nothing but a boy, trying to fight, trying to stay alive, helping you and your country survive for another day." Carrington's look of complete alarm brought me back to earth with a bump. I was never going to convince this tyrant of anything. I just needed to get out and stop making it worse for Carrington. We all knew that as soon as the door was closed behind me, that poor young man would be chastised and denigrated until his life was hardly worth living either.
"I think you should leave now," the Viscount said dismissively. "I don't know who you are, but I heartily suggest that you learn some manners, my good woman."
I took a brief look at Carrington, pensive, measured, silent, and then strode for the door. The butler was now holding it open for me, and I sailed straight out and walked down the majestic stone staircase to the driveway, exemplary lawns meted out on either side, beyond which the wild, rolling hills and forests were packed with their own teeming hierarchies, playing out their own chains of command. As I marched down the drive with a swing in my stride, I took a deep breath of the syrupy sweetness of summer, suffused with bees and birds. And I thought to myself how beautiful this world can be, how lucky we are to be here, to be part of it, for however long we have. I took the bus back to Chilbury, uneasy about the way that I'd left things with the Viscount. The malevolence and pride of these people is ruthless, clinging to their advantage in the face of our total annihilation. Human nature defeats me sometimes. Our greed and spite can lurk so divisively around the utmost courage and sacrifice. A sense of responsibility, or was it guilt, hung over me.
that I was in some way at fault because of cowering to all these pompous men all these years, when I should have had the bravery to reclaim my own mind. But if we women had done this years ago, before the last war, before this one, we'd be in a very different world. And what about Carrington, that poor devastated young man? Meeting him and Berkeley, even just briefly, makes me wonder why everyone makes such a fuss about homosexuality. Surely it's not so terribly wrong. And isn't love between two people better than hatred, in this world of violence and mourning? There seemed to me a fragile kindness in their love that survived through this poisonous war, even though one of them hadn't. By the time I reached Chilbury, just as the sun was stretching long shadows over the shop and the square, I was feeling quite fraught. I decided to visit the church to see if that would settle me. I ended up in the church more and more these days, waiting for the silence to seep inside. As I slipped through the overgrown graveyard, the mellow evening air rich with wild lavender and hawthorn, I found myself pausing by the ornate old grave of a young hero, a weathered statue of a sleeping lion resting over the top, its fat paws coveting the valuable body laid inside. But valuable to who? 200 years later, who was there left to remember this man, so carefully laid to rest, once so loved and real? Now all that would be left is a pile of dust, laid roughly in the shape of a human being, the frailness of our form putrid beside the enduring carved rock lion above it. I found tears coming fast. This war is too much for me. I'm not the kind of woman to be battling it out with a Viscount. I'm not built to deal with my son at war. Maybe suffering just like Berkeley, his fragile body left to decay like all human flesh. The war will be the end of me. I crumpled onto the grassy ground beside the grave, my face in my hands, wishing I could crawl away from all of this, pull the clock back to before the war started, and sleep for 1,000 years. A few drops of rain brought me back into the present, trickling down my back like a shiver of reality. I stood up slowly, the rain coming faster now, and turned to the church. Easing open the arched double doors, I slid silently into the wooden pew at the back and sat quietly. Here in the back row I could take my thoughts out for inspection, without fear of them spreading through my brain and taking me hostage. Today there was a figure a few rows from the front, tucked into the left side like me. The light from the shafts of stained-glass windows above the altar broke a blue and purple haze over him as he bent his head into his hands. It was Colonel Mallard. Was he invading my church now? Infuriated by his presence, I forgot my worries and found myself angry and frustrated with this war. These men bossing us about. I thought about leaving, but decided to stay for a short while and hopefully leave before he did. But my plan was ruined a few minutes later when he got up and turned to come back down the aisle. I saw him pause as he spotted me, but then he pressed on, nodding obliquely as he passed. I pretended that I hadn't noticed him, forcing my thoughts away as they kept flitting back to his presence. After the door shut behind him, I sat for a while, and then, suddenly feeling the need for normality, I got up and bustled out into the world, heading straight out of the graveyard and down the hill, towards home, my lovely, warm house. As I walked, I found myself thinking about how my view of the world has changed. Fancy me giving a Viscount a few strong words. And defying the law, taking a decision into my own hands to help this wounded young man. Perhaps there is something good that has come from this war. Everything has been turned around, all the unfairness made grimly plain. It has given us everyday women a voice, dared us to stand up for ourselves and to stand up for others. We have less to lose in this world of chaos and death, after all.
Kitty Winthrop's Diary. Wednesday, 24th of July, 1940. news about Sylvie's parents. Today we had a visit from Uncle Nicky. I was so excited, as I love the little conversations we have, usually sitting on a terrace if the evening's fine, talking about the world and being all grown up. But today he had no time for talks. He'd come with some news for Sylvie, and instead of the terrace, we sat solemnly in the drawing room.
"I'm afraid your parents and brother have disappeared, Sylvie. It's thought that they are hiding from the Nazis, maybe in someone's cellar, or they might be trying to escape overland to come and join you here. We obviously hope it's the latter, and that they can somehow make their way over, although it might be more difficult now with the Nazis controlling all the ports and borders."
She stared on with her big dark eyes, not saying anything, not even shedding a single tear.
"We have to be strong," Uncle Nicky said, taking her hands in his and holding them tightly, "and hope for the best."
She made a little curtsy, as if she couldn't open her mouth to say thank you, and trod carefully out of the room, closed the door, and then we heard the darting footsteps running through the hall and up the stairs and the bang of her bedroom door. Mama asked me to go and see if she was all right. Everyone knows I'm the best person for such a role. I quietly went upstairs and knocked on her door, but she didn't answer. So in the end, I just went in. She shouldn't be on her own, after all. She was lying on her bed, her face turned away from me, silent. "Please cheer up, Sylvie," I said, sitting on the bed. "They're probably on their way here." "But the awful part is that the journey will be incredibly dangerous, with almost all of mainland Europe under Nazi control. Even here we can feel the Nazis encroaching on us. The planes have started to come over the coastal towns and ports, bombing Dover almost weekly now. I know Sylvie thinks they're coming for her, the fear behind her eyes obvious whenever we hear those unbearable drones. "They are getting closer," she whispers to me, barely audibly. I sometimes wonder if she saw something back in Czechoslovakia, the Nazis in their full horror. Maybe she's replaying some gruesomely violent scene in her mind. Only the victim is her or her family. Before he left, I asked Uncle Nicky what happened in Czechoslovakia when the Nazis took over. "What happened to Sylvie, from what I can gather? Hitler claimed the western part of Czechoslovakia in 1938, and then last year tanks and troops rolled into the rest of Czechoslovakia, stealing food and everything else, hitting people who stood in their way, imprisoning people. Lots of homes and shops were destroyed, and lots of swastikas were put up by black-uniformed SS soldiers parading the streets. A lot of people in prison were shot, their families forced to pay for their executions. The Jews had their identification papers marked, so Sylvie had to leave quickly before anything happened to her. I've been incredibly lovely to Sylvie after learning all this. She still doesn't say anything, but perhaps I wouldn't if I'd gone through all that. That evening I asked Mama what would happen to Sylvie if her parents don't make it here until the war's over. "Sadly, we can't keep Sylvie here for long, as Daddy wouldn't like it, but she can stay for a while until it could be decided where she would do well." Mama wiped a tear from her eye. "She wants Sylvie to stay with us, but she has to do everything Daddy says." When I saw Daddy later, I tentatively brought up the subject of letting Sylvie stay, but he was as stubborn as ever.
"We can't have little evacuees from Lord knows where staying with us, becoming part of the family and so forth," he said. "What a ridiculous notion you have, Kitty, and your mother too."
He stormed around the room, picking up papers and books and slamming them down.
"Do you know there's a war on?" he shouted. "There are Nazi planes in our skies. One came down last week close to Dover, and the local defence volunteers haven't found the damned pilot yet. The country's in grave danger, and all you can think about is a blasted evacuee."
And that was that. Obviously, I'll have to think up some marvellous plan that will make him capitulate. Another fight with Venetia. Venetia is being completely intolerable. This morning, she stormed into my bedroom in her petticoat, hands on hips, furiously looking around. "Where's my sky blue dress, you thief? It doesn't fit you anymore, so I requisitioned it." I gave her a sharp smile. "I know that Mama would have told me to do the same." "It does still fit me, you little twerp. All night dresses have gone missing, and I knew it was you." She spat. In any case, it's courteous to ask before you take something. She had come right up to me, standing a foot away, putting her crazed, pursed-up face right into mine. I backed away. I only borrowed this one, I said. I don't know where the others have gone. Maybe the maid's been taking them. I needed this one for a picnic. A picnic with who? Sylvie and I went on our very own little picnic. I wanted to show her what it was like in the good old days. You know, before the war. Remember the time we went to Box Hill with Henry? She stood up straight again and seemed to forget the dress dispute for a moment, her mind flitting back to that July day. That was the first time Henry proposed to me, she laughed. What a funny day that was. Do you remember how I cut in, feeling the blood gush hot into my face. But he proposed to me that day. I couldn't believe what she was saying. He proposed to me. Don't be ridiculous, Kitty, she smirked. He could only have proposed to one of us. She stood back, arms folded, laughing slightly. And it was me. I stood firm. Think I might have been gripping my fist by my sides because I wanted to punch her ridiculous mouth. But now I remember. I declined his proposal, so perhaps you're right after all, she joked in a patronizing tone. Perhaps he was saddened and desperate after being turned down, and then saw little you and felt sorry for you. We all know you've been infatuated with him for years. If I'd had Daddy's shotgun with me right there and then, I would have taken it out and pulled the trigger straight into her vile, spiteful heart. But he asked me and I said yes, I fumed. He was only joking with you, Kitty, she laughed. Of course he isn't interested in a stupid child like you. It's me he wants, a real woman. With this, she did that ludicrous pouting with her lips, like a big, wet salmon, and I pulled back in disgust. Whatever you've got, I don't want it, and neither does Henry. Of course he does, darling. The look on her face was utter, determined domination. He's crazy about me. So why didn't you accept him if he proposed to you? I demanded. Because I'm waiting for someone better. Like that weasel Slater. He's not a weasel. She looked away and I glimpsed a flicker of uncertainty. He's worth a million of Henry. Really, Venetia? And I took out my trump card. A black market dealer is better than Henry. She unfolded her arms and something in her posture crumpled. You know. She didn't seem shocked, just wary, treading carefully, trying to understand. Now it was my turn to be smug. I saw him in Peaspot of Wood doing business with a crook called Old George. When? I don't see why I should tell you. I moved to the dressing table and started tidying my hair clips. You'll have to beg me first, and apologize about what you said about Henry not proposing to me. She stood completely still for a moment, then turned to the door. I'll do no such thing, you little shrew. I'll just have to go and find out for myself. And off she stormed back to her room, forgetting about the dress, the picnic, the proposal. I found the sky blue dress and tried it on again. I'll have to wear it next time I see Henry to remind him of our engagement. I'm sure it'll trigger his memory.
Letter from Lieutenant Carrington to Mrs. Tilling. Parnham House, Parnham, Kent. Telephone, Parnham 47. Friday, 26th July, 1940. Dear Mrs. Tilling, I want to thank you for coming all the way to Parnham to give me the ring. I imagine it was not a pleasant task, and realize that you had no obligation to come, which makes me all the more grateful for your visit and concern. Since then, I have become employed, which serves a dual purpose of getting me out of the house and providing me with more to think about than the war and lost friends. The surgeon came and deemed me unfit to fight for the time being, and so I have been given a job at Lichfield Park, pushing pieces of paper around and phoning people up to tell them what's on the pieces of paper. It's rather dreary, but they say they'll move me into something more interesting as soon as they can. I'm hoping to be sent to London, which would mean a lodging to myself. If ever you are in the area, please do come and say hello, as I feel I wasn't as polite as I could have been, and want to thank you properly for coming so far out of your way to visit. If there is anything I could possibly do for you, please do not hesitate to ask. I would only be too delighted to reciprocate in whatever way I can. With thanks and very best wishes, Lieutenant Rupert Carrington.
Letter from Venetia Winthrop to Angela Quayle. Chilbury Manor, Chilbury, Kent. Saturday, the 27th of July, 1940. Dearest Angie, everything is getting more complicated at every turn. I was sent to Dover yesterday to assess the bomb damage, and the place was half demolished and fast earning its nickname, Hellfire Corner. Even while I was there, enemy planes appeared in the sky, circling loudly, their Nazi swastikas clearly visible on their sides. I thought I was going to be sick. A few of our chaps in Spitfires and Hurricanes came along to drive them out, and it became a bit of a dogfight, right there in the skies above us. Some of the locals came out of shops and stood in the high street cheering them on. But I couldn't bear it. All this charade for more deaths, more ruined lives. What has become of us? A great deal seems to have happened since last I wrote. The main news is that I think I'm pregnant. I'm not at all sure how to feel about this, and I'm rather hoping that I'm not. I thought I was being careful, but I suppose one never knows with these things. Obviously, I haven't breathed a word to Alistair or anyone else. I do so wish you were here, Angie. I know you're thinking that it's all frightfully simple. Alistair and I will have to get married. But, you see, I've also come to suspect that Alistair is involved in the black market. Instead of being the wife of a romantic artist, living in a tumble-down castle on an island in a river, I would be the wife of a hardened criminal, always on the run, always afraid. Frankly, Angie, it's not the life I had planned at all. I found out through Kitty, of all people, in the middle of one of our stupid rows. Just as I thought we'd finished, she rounded on me, announcing that she'd spotted Alistair in Peas Potter Wood, doing business with a common crook. I can't get over it. It seems so unlike him. So contrary to the gentle, sophisticated artist. I know I've had my suspicions, but this... I stormed off, but then I had to pull myself together for Rose's christening, which was this afternoon. We'd done some extra practicing so that the Chilbury Ladies' Choir could do something special, processing out of the choir stalls and surrounding Hattie and Rose, singing a gorgeous rendition of All Things Bright and Beautiful. When it reached the part that goes, "Each little flower that opens, each little bird that sings," we were all gathered round them, and Hattie looked like she'd burst with joy. After the service, everyone went to Hattie's house in Church Row for a small afternoon tea party, and I stayed to tidy up afterwards, although I was more keen to get her advice about Alistair. Kitty saw him in Peas Potter Wood with a black marketeer. He was doing business with him, Hattie. I was getting a bit upset, pacing up and down the sitting room, clearing the plates and crashing them into the sink. "Goodness," Hattie said, moving Rose's pram away from the activity. She's getting frightfully mother hennish. "Well, perhaps it's time to give him up, Venetia. I don't mean to be heartless, but I worry about you, and I don't think getting involved with him will bring you any happiness." "I don't know." I flopped down in a chair. "All I know for certain is that I can't stop being with him without breaking my heart in the process. I know it sounds ridiculous, but I can't leave without getting to the bottom of it. It simply means too much to me." "What does your mother think of all this?" "Mama is completely taken up with baby Lawrence, who still won't keep down any milk. She's also busy with Daddy, as he's become so volatile. Kitty's running amok, and Sylvie's being looked after by Kitty and old Nanny Godwin, from what I can gather. No one seems to care what we do, or what's happening." "Well, don't worry about them for now. Think of what you need to do." She patted my hand gently. "Isn't there a way you could find out more before deciding?" "I've made up my mind to follow him," I told her, with sudden conviction. She sighed a great sigh, and it dawned on me that she's the only one who ever really looked after me.
"Well, just be careful,"
she said, "and please give up if it gets too dangerous, Venetia. You don't always have to be the brave and daring one." I went to the door and looked back, feeling such warmth and concern from her. "I'll let you know how it goes.
You know, I'll always worry about you, Venetia," she said,
and I suddenly felt like crying. So I quickly turned and paced determinedly across the green, the ducks waddling fast to avoid my feet. I took a deep breath of the warm summer air and prayed I'd come out of this alive. "I'll write as soon as I can and tell you how it all goes. Fingers crossed. Venetia."
Mrs. Tilling's Journal. Monday the 29th of July, 1940. What an odd thought occurred to me today. I'm still trying to think it all through. The morning was quite usual as I popped over to the surgery to help deal with everyone's aches and pains. Since the war started, people come to see me when they're out of sorts, even if there isn't much wrong with them. Mrs. Turner, whose husband was killed in one of the air raids on Dover, has developed an ongoing cough with no apparent cause. She comes in most days to see me. I try to offer kind words, but she edges back as if unable to bear it, her face grey like a ghost's. All we can do is make more tea and give her some aspirin. Mrs. Quayle got her to join the choir, and although she remained silent for a full half hour, she finally managed a few lines of "Praise My Soul." It was an oddly moving moment for all of us, as if we were trying to bring a crushed bird back to life with nothing but song. After luncheon, I had to pop over to Hattie's, where she tried to convince me that little Rose is the image of Victor, and I couldn't help thinking it odd that she doesn't look like either of them. In fact, baby Lawrence with his sprouts of dark hair looks more like Hattie. And then I remembered noticing at the christening that Rose had the same colouring as her godmother, Venetia. And that started me thinking about it all. The nasty medicine. The fact that both births happened on the same afternoon, the afternoon that I was in Lichfield. Then they both had the same breathing problem, both requiring resuscitation at Miss Poultry's house. And when I'd met Miss Poultry in the square that day, I'd imagined, or ridiculously I thought at the time, that there was a noise coming from her bag. Could it have been a child? Could she have swapped the babies? I shuddered at the horror of the idea. I think I must have looked a little dazed as Hattie touched my elbow and said, "Are you all right, Mrs. Tilling?" I pulled myself together sharply. I can't have anyone suspecting anything until I have more time to think it all through, until I have proof. "It's fine, dear," I said, smiling. "I just remembered I need to hurry a little today, because I need to check on Mrs. Winthrop's little one, too." I pondered a moment, then asked, "Do you remember when poor Rose had that breathing problem after she was born?" "How could I forget it? It was the worst moment of my life." "Did you see little Rose at all before Miss Poultry took her away?" Her eyes looked doubtful, questioning my question, and I had to quickly put her at ease. "I mean, you should have at least been able to hold her before she was whisked away from you." Hattie's thin face crumpled into tears. "No, I hardly saw her pretty little face before she was rushed out." She looked down at the baby in her arms and her shoulders relaxed. "She was gone a whole 5 minutes. I was beside myself. I pulled myself out of bed and hauled myself down to the front door, and Miss Poultry was back with my precious little baby." She gave Rose a little kiss. Their faces together and opposite. Hers slim and delicate. The baby's heart-shaped and blonde. And I suddenly questioned the value of revealing any ideas I had. After all, wasn't Mrs. Winthrop delighted with her boy, too? Didn't they need a boy to keep the inheritance? That's when it dawned on me. Perhaps this wasn't simply the whim of an unscrupulous midwife. Perhaps there was more to it than met the eye. I took my leave and made haste to Chilbury Manor, where Mrs. Winthrop was at home. We sat in the drawing room and she asked Elsie to bring some tea, and it felt almost as if the war had never happened. She looked tired and harassed, which must mean the Brigadier's being unbearable again. I'm doing some studies on babies born with breathing problems, so I wondered if I could ask you a few more questions about Lawrence's birth, I began carefully. I didn't want her to suspect anything fishy. I thought I'd gone through it all with you, she sighed. It was so distressing. I'm not sure I'm quite up for going through it again. Just a few questions. Did Miss Poultry take the baby away straight away, or did she let you see or hold him first? No, she had to leave immediately. He was in great distress. Her story collaborated with my theory. I quickly pressed on. Was she carrying baby Lawrence in her black bag when she returned with him? Of course not, Mrs. Winthrop exclaimed, and I realized I'd gone too far. In any case, even Miss Poultry would have the intelligence to take the baby out of the bag beforehand. Elsie had come in with the tea, and I wondered if she'd overheard. She smiled a little. Would you like sugar? I had to stay and talk about normal things for a while before I could get away, and then I rushed back home to sit and think it all through. It seemed such a ridiculous notion. Such a dramatic act for a person to do. Unless someone was paying her.
Kitty Winthrop's Diary. Wednesday, 31st of July, 1940. Prim had the most wonderful idea. We're to have a memorial service for everyone to come together and help those grieving. I think Mrs. Tilling prompted her by mentioning Mrs. Turner, whose husband was killed in a bombing raid over Dover. And there's poor Mrs. Poultice, too. It's important for them to know that we're grieving with them, Prim told me in my singing lesson today, which was held in the church for extra acoustics. I sang the Lord's Prayer, the fullness of the sound making my voice sound extremely professional. She said I could sing it as a solo for the memorial service, which is to be in a few weeks' time. I always arrive early for choir practice as it's a wonderful moment. The excitement of singing, everyone glad to see each other, and today was no different, especially since we have the Nazis on our backs ready to invade. So we have to make the most of everything while we can. I've been working hard all day preparing for the WVS meeting, Mrs. B was complaining, never getting a word of thanks or any rest. You have to let us know how we can help, Mrs. Tilling said. Unfortunately, I'm the only one who can handle leadership around here. Mrs. Tilling began, I could There's no other way around it. Mrs. B's voice rose over Mrs. Tilling's, like a tornado overwhelming a welcome breeze. And Mrs. Quayle said she'd... Mrs. Tilling pressed on. If you need something done, Mrs. B boomed, and we all knew what was coming, so we joined in. You have to do it yourself. Prim arrived in time to hear the end of this, and to see Mrs. B fuming as some of us giggled behind our hands. Let's get organized, ladies, Prim said, hiding a smile and handing around some new music scores. We are to have a memorial service for the Chilbury community to help us join together in our time of grief. Everyone quietly agreed and opened the music scores. I've chosen a piece from Mozart's Requiem, Lacrimosa, which means tearful, beautifully describing this heartfelt piece. It's more complicated than our usual hymns and anthems, but I think we can give it a try. It's one of my favourite pieces of music, a massive ocean of sorrow. We opened our music scores to see the complicated patterns of notes. Shall we try it out? Let's all stand. Just try your best, feel the music take hold of you, and don't worry if you sing anything wrong. The introduction began, and I knew exactly what she meant. The piece is like a series of waves gushing over you, becoming larger and more powerful as it goes on, until the incredible strident amen at the end, as if we have survived it all, stronger than ever. Lovely, Prim said as she brought the finale to a close, sniffing a little with the emotion of it. Let's try it again, shall we? This time, Let's try to feel the sadness of it. Let yourself flow into the music. Let it speak your own grief. The introduction began again, this time slower, more thoughtfully. And then we came in with the first tentative notes. As we sang, Mrs. Turner crumpled into the alto's choir stool, her hands over her face, her hunched body shuddering with tears. Mrs. Poultice sat down beside her, putting her arm around her shoulder, beginning to cry herself. And a new dread crept into our singing, as if we were singing for them, for everyone who had lost someone, or could. By the time we reached the powerful chords towards the end, we were almost crying with our song, louder, more raucous than before, until the final amen, when we all stood together, firm in the power of our choir to face this war together. "Let's finish for tonight," Prim said quietly. We silently folded our music scores and went over to Mrs. Turner and Mrs. Poultice, putting our arms around them, holding their hands, whispering our condolences. People were putting their hands around Mama as well, as she is still mourning Edmund, and Sylvie, so far from her family, and Mrs. Tilling and the other mothers and wives, all worried about their loved ones in this horrific war. "You always have us," Mrs. Quayle said to Mrs. Turner. "I know we can't replace your husband, but remember we are here all together. The Chilbury Ladies' Choir stands with you."
Letter from Venetia Winthrop to Angela Quayle. Chilbury Manor, Chilbury, Kent. Thursday, the 1st of August, 1940. My dearest Angie, I was awake at dawn almost paralyzed with fear. As today, I was resolved to follow Alistair. I knew that he was busy this morning with his so-called meetings, as I tried to arrange something, and he resolutely refused. Of course, I hardly slept a wink. I was so certain that I'd face probable death on this outing that I almost let myself off the hook, snuggling down under the counterpane for extra protection. What made me get up in the end was the thought that my pregnancy is becoming less of a possibility and more of a reality. I have to know what to do. I got up around 4, dressed quietly, and took one last look around me. Would I ever see my dear bedroom again? Stealing softly down the back stairs and through the pantry, I stepped out into the still, dark air. I slowly crept into the lane, feeling like the only person alive, although I'm sure some of the farmhands down in Dorking's farm would have been hard at work in the fields. There was a light mist that lingered in the air, coating the village with a wordless hush. As I reached the square, silver-grey in mist, I almost collided with a small black van that was parked outside the shop, one of Ralph Gibbs' black market deliveries, no doubt, which hopefully had nothing to do with Alistair. Had I noticed him speaking to Ralph? Not that I could recall. But did that mean anything? Did any of my recollections mean anything? Or have I been living in a world that is only half complete, a dream within a dream? I went round to my spying spot at the end of Church Row, where I could see both the front and back of Alistair's house, from behind a hedge. Then I began my wait. Sitting in the dark, waiting for someone to appear is extremely tedious, especially as I was in two minds about whether this was a good plan after all. And I was just checking that my wristwatch was working properly at around 6, when finally he appeared on the path in the back garden, heading out of the little gate and into the pasture. Immaculate as usual, with a beige raincoat over his suit. He walked briskly away from me, pausing momentarily to smell the morning air. Dawn had lifted the mist, and it had blossomed into a heavenly morning, all pale yellow and crisp with dew. How I longed for this wretched scheme to be over! I hopped nimbly out from behind the hedge and crouched beside it as he stalked down the edge of the field, away from me, going at quite a pace. After he'd gone into the next field, he headed towards the manor, which I thought an odd route. I trotted after him, watching him take an abrupt detour through the bushes at the verge and dashing across the lane, and then making a couple of quick turns towards Pease Potter Wood. I was finding it hard to watch where he was going without being seen, and suspected his circuitous route had been created in order to avoid meeting people and lose any trailers. He certainly wasn't losing me, though. Before he reached the wood, he crossed a very exposed field, with no bushes or hedges on either side, and I had to stay at the bottom until he was virtually in the trees. It was there, and I was hiding in a rather prickly bush, that he turned to scrutinize the scene, and I felt that his eyes may have lingered on me for a split second before he vanished into the trees. I didn't think that he saw me. Surely he would have come and got me if he had. But that brief moment made me draw breath. I had to be more careful. I sprinted up the narrow path and plunged into the wood. I hadn't been in Peaspotter Wood for years, and yet I still remembered all the tracks. The path to the pixie ring. Alistair was heading into the chestnut patch, the place Kitty and I used to play as children. Their broad, barrel-like trunks, as old and sturdy as the whole of England. I thought about her, and how we'd been friends so long ago. Alistair suddenly stopped in a clearing, so I darted behind one of the larger chestnuts, peeking my head around the side, where I could watch through the shrubbery. Then I spotted a man up ahead approaching him. He was stocky and powerful, built like a gladiator, and dressed in an old suit that was obviously not his, as it was too short in the legs and arms. They spoke for a while in low voices, and I stared at the stranger. He must be a criminal in hiding, living rough, perhaps in the wood itself. He was furious about something, that was for certain, and I was suddenly afraid for Alistair, afraid for our little village, and utterly petrified of what might happen if he found me there. Alistair was calmly engaging with him, his hands gesticulating as if trying to pacify him. He took a small packet from his inside pocket and handed it over, and the stranger took it cautiously and went to put it in his pocket, but then changed his mind and wrenched it open, examining the contents. For some reason, I'd expected it to be a wad of money, but it wasn't. There were two little black booklets, and as he turned them over in his hands, I recognized first a ration book and then a passport. Alistair was helping this man to escape the country. The stranger was getting more heated, flinging the booklets back in the packet and shoving it into his pocket. And as his voice became louder, snarling through the bracken, a flash of frozen horror shot through me as I realized that he wasn't speaking English. The language he was using, without any doubt, was German. What was he doing here? Was he a spy? How did he get here? Had he parachuted in? Why was he wearing odd clothes? Was he going to kill us all? We've been told to keep a lookout for the enemy, but I never imagined I'd actually see one. Or that he'd be meeting with Alistair. Straining my ears to listen for Alistair's reply, I almost retched when I heard German words coming out of his mouth, so alien from his normal English tones. I abruptly grasped the full weight of the situation. How little I really knew him. After a few final enraged words, the man strode off into the wood, thankfully in the opposite direction to me. Alistair stood watching him leave for a minute, and then turned and, to my complete dismay, headed straight towards the place where I was hiding. I sprang behind the tree and held my breath, pinning my back and arms to the sheltering trunk, listening to the rustle of his footsteps through the undergrowth as they came closer and closer. I didn't have a clue whether he'd seen me, whether he was heading back out of the wood, or coming in my direction to root me out. What would he do to me? I swallowed hard, fighting back a growing panic. It was when he stopped next to the tree, on the other side of me, that I became certain that he knew I was there. I heard him again quietly treading around the tree, and saw him slowly appear, his finger on his lips. He eased his way around until he was beside me, his back next to mine against the broad trunk, and as we both stood there, his fingers moved over and found my fingers, and interlaced them softly between his. I felt heat surge up through my hand and arm and into my head. What is wrong with me, Angie? I was terrified he'd pull me against him and slit my throat. And yet I longed for him so badly I could hardly breathe. He did neither. He just turned his head to look at me, and I could see a different look in his eyes. A melancholy I'd never seen in him before. After a few minutes, he broke his gaze, then pulled away and glanced around the side of the tree. And then, just like that, off he went, grasping my hand and pulling me after him, darting through the trees as fast as we could go. I almost stumbled a few times, but the tug of his hand dragged me onward. I was petrified and exhausted. What did he intend to do with me? All of a sudden, we tumbled into a clearing, the golden morning sunshine tunneling through the gap in the treetops. It was as if the world had survived after all, glorious and resplendent in the pale early morning glow. "Which way?" he whispered, panting in the warm air. "Here," I said, quietly, catching his hand, leading him down through the trees. "The edge of the wood is just down here, and then we can skirt the orchard down to Bull's End Brook. It leads to the back of Dawkins' farm, and you can go back to the village from the other side." I was thinking of the fastest route to the fields, where the men would be working, someone to hear my cry for help if need be. As we came out of the orchard and entered the copse around the brook, we began to slow down. He still kept hold of my hand, his thumb brushing the back of my fingers. It was strange, as we never liked to be seen together in public. I am cautious about Daddy seeing us, and he is, well, just cautious, which doesn't seem surprising now. But there we were, hand in hand like young lovers, water trickling over the smooth grey rocks below as we walked through the glistening trees, in and out of the shade of the branches, in a strange juxtaposition between good and evil. "You're more than I bargained for, Venetia," he said quietly. "So are you," I spluttered, not really knowing where to begin.
"Why did you follow me?"
he asked. "I couldn't believe you were involved in the black market," I replied, "and yet it seems to be the least of your ventures." He looked confused for a moment, then said,
"Oh, Kitty must have told you."
As if that cleared up everything. "I followed you because I had to find out more about the black marketing. Obviously, I had no idea I'd find out you're a Nazi spy, too," I snipped. "Are there any illegal activities you don't do, Alistair?" He smiled. Yes, smiled, as if he were proud of himself.
"Well, I don't do many at all. Unless you count house burglary, I dabbled in a spot of forgery once, which was quite interesting. I felt it improved my art, actually."
I was stunned, and stopped walking for a moment to take it all in. I mean, I knew he was a black marketeer and everything, but he sounded like a completely renegade criminal, who clearly had no conscience whatsoever. "And now you're a traitor too," I said limply. I looked up into his clear brown eyes, the words so ugly and clumsy in my mouth, so repulsive. "How could you help the enemy? And on our own soil, too!" I was angry with him for letting me down, angry for what he was doing. "I never knew you spoke German. How many other people are you, Alistair?"
"Many,"
he said simply.
"I speak French, too, if that's any consolation."
"Why would that be a consolation?" I said, and started walking again.
"It's a lot more complicated, Venetia. I can't tell you about it right now, but you have to trust me."
He came after me, trying to take my hand. "How could it get more complicated?" I spat, snatching my hand away. "You're a criminal and a traitor. Most people would be satisfied with just one, criminal or traitor. But no, Alistair Slater has to be both." Then I added, "and a very poor artist, just in case that's not enough." He laughed.
"Oh, Venetia, I'm not really that bad an artist, am I?"
"Yes," I smarted. "You had my portrait completely wrong. You don't know me at all. You've had me wrong all along."
"I see that I have,"
he smirked, although I could see he was getting ruffled.
"I'll change it, Venetia. I'll find the painting, and I'll change it. I'll make you into the gentle goddess that you are."
"Why should you bother?" I shouted. "I'd have thought another minx would be exactly your style." I turned to face him. You have a nerve asking me to trust you, when all you've done is...